Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to another edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent and Leighton Kling. We've got obligatory Prime coverage leading our show, that is Prime Day coverage from Amazon. Surprising news, a couple of news pieces by way of Bloomberg regarding True Value and Albertsons, and also a look ahead at what the company Valor may want with the remains of retailer H.H. Gregg. The Retail Focus Podcast is brought to you by Third Wave Water and ThirdWaveWater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order and start making better coffee at home today through their proprietary blend of minerals you can add to a gallon of distilled water to create some coffee brewing magic. That's Third Wave Water, ThirdWaveWater.com. Use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order.
We're also brought to you by WarbyParker.com, which provides vintage-inspired prescription eyeglasses starting at the $95 price point. And if you're like my brother or myself, your eyes are not perfect, so you occasionally either have to put in contacts or a pair of glasses. Why not put on glasses that have a rebellious spirit and have a lofty objective to offer designer eyewear at a revolutionary price? That is what Warby Parker is doing while leading the way for socially conscious businesses. Get a free 5-day home try-on at warbyparkertrial.com/focus. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free.
Well, I may be blind without glasses or contacts, but I'm not blind enough to see the sales success at Amazon through their Prime Day sales. Now, in terms of how much sales were actually up over last year, it's impossible to tell. Amazon released numbers mentioning they saw a 60% increase over last year's Prime Day top line revenue. Although, given some other numbers out there, I think it's reasonable to actually question that number, and we've seen some shaky numbers come out of Amazon in the past. But the bottom line is, Leighton, they extended their event to 30 hours this year, and it seemed to make a market impact.
And just to clarify, it did start on the evening of Monday, July 10th, and ran those 30 hours, according to Amazon, ran 24 hours in 2016, ran 30 hours all the way through Tuesday. The bulk of the deals didn't get kicked off until early Tuesday morning. This year marked the third and biggest Prime Day for the company, and this is why the story is number one this week. It ran in 13 countries overall. You see three additional territories included in this Prime Day event: China, India, and Mexico. And if you look at those very vast regions from the outside, you can see that those are some of the biggest markets for Amazon, and Amazon's really trying to get in China to compete with Alibaba. This year, you see the deals popped off every few minutes in nearly all of Amazon's categories. Tens of millions of users shopped, according to Amazon. 50% more Prime members purchased at least one item, and certain shopping app features allowed Prime members to watch, buy, and track the sales of the items that they were most interested in. And you see, besides a few glitches here and there and complaints of users not being easily able to search for specific items, the Amazon event really did prove successful after statements released by company executives earlier this week. You see, hundreds of thousands of items were discounted either by time sales, coupons, or deals with specific vendors and manufacturers. You saw a lot of those deals where if you would spend X amount of dollars with a certain vendor, you would get maybe 30, 20% off, something of that nature. So a lot of different ways you could have saved on Prime Day if you had either the Prime trial or the Prime membership. The company used the day to advertise those very memberships as well as their Echo products, which were also heavily discounted. And this was actually the lead story for several financial media outlets. You see that leading up to Prime sales, Amazon promoted their unlimited Amazon Music service as well, that can be streamed through the Echo, where people were able to buy 4 months of that service for just 99 cents. But the Echo, on average, it was reported that there were 6,000 orders per minute for the devices because they were so heavily discounted for this 30-hour period. The Echo was 50% off, while the Echo Dot, the smaller version of the Echo, was about 30% off. Overall, the Echo devices proved to be Amazon's highest selling item, according to Amazon, of course, selling over 5 times more than they did last year. And with this, more users will be tied to the platform, of course, for other things like home entertainment and personal assistant needs. And this really is an entrance for Amazon trying to create their own brand and something that they've been trying out. Obviously, they've tried out other technologies, but this is something that really does tie Prime users into the Amazon platform. This helps out with everything, not just the retail side of the business, but all facets of their business. So not just with the Prime membership can Amazon look to drive loyalty and ubiquity throughout. As a refresher, it should be noted Amazon was offering the $10.99 per month subscription model for their platform. You could do the monthly or the yearly for $99 a year. So that price stayed the same. And Trent, it is a question of how they reached their audience this year for Prime Day. It was said that they spent a lot more money with ad spend, and you see that there was a lot of avenues for marketing this year.
Part of that ad spend certainly comes from the fact that they were in three more markets, those larger markets like China and India that Leighton had mentioned, but they also launched a massive TV ad campaign. They were active in campaigns on Twitter and Facebook, among others, and I thought it was interesting as some analysts after the fact pointed to the idea that Amazon was not so much advertising Prime Day as a membership event to where you could sign up for a Prime membership, but they've started to pivot somewhat, noting that Prime growth is slowed and that they may be reaching maturation of their overall Prime concept. They started pushing the Echo and Echo Dot quite a bit more heavily in marketing. And some people are taking this by extension to mean that perhaps the market is nearing saturation point with these Prime memberships. Now, that's a little bit of an extrapolation due to the fact that we don't have a ton of data in regards to Prime memberships. No one really knows how many Prime members there are. Only Amazon does. Estimates range anywhere between 50 million and 85 million for Prime members for Amazon. But that's likely part of the reason why you saw that de-emphasized in marketing and you saw more of the deals, including the Echo, emphasized in their television ad campaign, among other ad campaigns. A lot of their marketing actually had to do with some of their entertainment offerings. Leighton mentioned already the Amazon Music services, but also they offered deals on games and streaming videos. Analysts also stated that the level of marketing this year showed that Amazon wants it to stand out like a manufactured holiday, like a Black Friday or Cyber Monday type of event, akin to Singles Day that Alibaba puts on in China. This runs contrary a little bit to Bezos's prior claim that Prime Day was really just like any other sale for Amazon or any other summer sale for Amazon. What I found most interesting, though, is all the anti-Prime Day advertising that took place this year. And we'll talk a little bit later on about some of the anti-Prime Day stances from labor organizations and the like. But in terms of other companies, they're trying to jump on the Prime Day bandwagon, kind of ride the coattails from Amazon and cut into a piece of that overall Prime Day pie. Probably the most notable of these was eBay. They ran a header on their website on Prime Day with something that said to the effect of, every day is Prime Day here, every day is Prime here. This was part of a larger campaign that they rolled out called Did You Check eBay to try and keep customers from settling for Prime Day deals. The biggest deal on eBay may have been fueled, in fact, by Google, as eBay and Google hooked up to offer a bundle of Google Home and Chromecast for $99.99. Google Home is Google's competition attempt with Amazon Echo, but they are lagging a little bit in terms of market share. The Google Home service has just 23.8% of the voice-activated assistant market share in the U.S. versus Amazon's 70.6%. Certainly, you can see that Amazon's share of the market much bigger than Google's. Probably one of the reasons why Google partnered with not only eBay, but also a retailer like Newegg to offer a bundle deal for Google Home and try to get some of those services tied in with Google rather than their competitor in Amazon, at least their competitor in terms of a number of web services. This campaign for eBay, though, did pay off, as did Prime Day runoff, as eBay set a July sales record on Prime Day earlier this week. Looking at some of the other deals, we mentioned Newegg. They had quite a few promo code-based sales, including some deals that were honestly a little bit convoluted, not quite as simple as the typical Prime Day deals, like a $10 off promo code, for example. And on a gaming laptop, they had a $150 mail-in rebate. There were a lot of mail-in rebates there for Newegg. Best Buy had a number of remarkable deals, 25% off rates on the iPad Pro, 32 gig flash drives from SanDisk for $7.99 as well. Toys R Us jumped into the fray. It's not just technology here. They had a blanket 20% off everything ordered online through Toys R Us on Prime Day. The benefit, of course, to some of these other deals through eBay, through Newegg, through Best Buy, through Toys R Us, and so forth, is that for the consumer, there's no need to sign up for Prime. And this is going to be the differentiator for these other e-commerce businesses going forward on Prime Day, saying to the customer, hey, you don't need to sign up for a service. You don't need to pay an upfront membership fee like you would at a warehouse club to be able to access these deals. And I feel like this will serve some of the other e-commerce retailers well in the future and may eventually eat into Amazon's market share on Prime Day, despite the fact that it's really kind of a created Prime Day from Amazon themselves. Layton, as you delved into some of the news stories and some of the associative exploits by Amazon in relation to Prime Day, I think you found something interesting in terms of how Amazon was attempting to get some of their third-party partners to advertise Prime Day.
Yeah, absolutely. Amazon has a huge fulfillment program, and not only that, they offer a lot of entrepreneurs the ability to sell their merchandise on the Amazon platform here in the United States. And in statements made by the company, it seems as though they had and openly wanted participation by small businesses and product-based entrepreneurs to help take part in Prime Day. This means that these businesses would have to discount their merchandise in order to make it more attractive for those either first visiting the site or those just wanting to take part in the Prime Day exploits. But we see, while no exact figures were given, there were more adoption rates on the selling platforms overall with these smaller businesses. And some argued this is actually more of a play to get additional and free advertising for Prime Day. And this is interesting because if you take a look at this, you can see that, for instance, if a small company is starting to sell through the Amazon selling platform, they are going to feel obligated to participate in something as massive as this. And therefore, the sellers are going to be talking to their customers about the event, which in turn directs traffic to Amazon.com, which could in turn either do one of two things. One, the customers could go to a competitor of that website, or in the end, it could just hurt their bottom line as they have to deeply discount their product mix in order to compete overall with that diversified product mix that is on Amazon. So it's not necessarily the win for that small business or the entrepreneur. Yes, their brand gets out there. Yes, Amazon is going to do their best to have everything displayed in a proper fashion. But at the end of the day, I think these smaller businesses, I'm curious to see what some of these owners say about how Amazon really works for their business, if it affects their bottom line or not, if their profitability is affected by year's end. However, to Amazon's credit, a lot of their advertising was blanketed towards the day as a whole. Not a lot of specific items other than the Echo, which we've talked at length about. It's been more about the common goods on the Amazon fulfillment platform. And you see, overall, Amazon did outperform, according to analysts and the statements from Amazon. As we take a general look at the company's performance over this past week, you can see that they have attracted more customers than ever, which has resulted in the highest amount of Prime memberships. However, as you alluded to, Trent, we can't really delve into those numbers exactly. Estimates are very varied across all of the analysts inside the United States as to how many people exactly have signed up for Prime, and of those, how many have signed up for a full year commitment. Those numbers are completely unknown. So you even see a lot of analysts saying that potentially global memberships are equivalent to what others think the US memberships are. So just a lot of guesswork to be done there in that category. It is all put on the income statement under retail, so we really don't know those exact numbers. But For Amazon's part, they had no major site crashes, no major controversy this year, and traffic was reported to be up 5%. However, the one bad side is if you look at the conversion rate, which we talked about regularly when it comes to e-commerce, this was actually down from 14.5% to 11.4%. This, according to SimilarWeb, this may be a result of people visiting the site, but either already having the major discounted products or being unhappy with the discounts. And I think truly, Trent, this has a lot to do with people visiting the platform multiple times, especially for something like Prime Day, where you're constantly checking on certain items and then some items are sold out. So of course, you're not going to get a conversion rate there if you have a 100% sellout rate on some items. We should keep in mind that their traditional conversion rates are around 8.4%, or they were in June at least. They say overall sales on this Prime Day were up 60% year over year, which would actually match some analysts at JP Morgan as they came out with a statement earlier this week citing a 55% or at least a supposed 55% growth year over year in those sales, which would actually make the company sell over $1 billion in merchandise. Obviously, they don't see all of that on the bottom line. It's more of eBay's metric of gross merchandise volume, how much you're selling in total and the value of those transactions. Shareholders seemed to like what they were hearing out of Amazon headquarters. They bragged about how Prime Now deliveries are just taking 12 minutes in Kirkland, Washington, and in Berkeley, California. Matt Sargent, the senior vice president of Frank and Magid Associates, said to Forbes that this is a differentiator for Amazon over Walmart and Costco. The shipping obviously is a perk for some people, but if you live in those markets, yes, it's going to be a perk, but other 99% of people in the country are not going to be seeing maybe those quick deliveries. We're talking, again, at 10, 12 minutes time. And honestly, Trent, where you and I live, we're still seeing more of a two-day wait for some items and some things that are very popular in those bigger markets that you're seeing faster shipping dates with.
Couple other quick notes about Prime Day. There was backlash, at least on the labor front, regarding Amazon's Prime Day. And of course, anytime you toss Amazon's name into the mix, there's going to be some sort of reflection from a labor organization. This year, the UFCW, which represents a lot of food employees, a lot of retail workers, put out a release asking customers to consider the real costs of Amazon. And this is something that is worth exploring at least longer term, and this is something that will follow. If the country continues to see unemployment creeping downwards, and as the country continues to edge towards full employment, not only full employment, but people being in jobs where they'd like to be, Amazon could have a tough time drawing people to jobs in warehouses and that type of thing, where we've heard in the past from other media outlets, things like bathroom breaks are discouraged. They might have a difficult time continuing to find fulfillment employees on that. And I don't think the minimum wage might hurt them too much as long as it's on a city-by-city basis. But I think longer term, they may have difficulty making sure that they do get orders fulfilled, especially in times of seasonal importance like Prime Day, like Black Friday, like the holiday season. Shares of the stock for Amazon are up modestly this week by about 2%, coming up close to an all-time high, currently right around $1,000 per share versus $741 per share at this time 1 year ago. Their market cap, a whopping $484 billion, which is beginning to look a little bit more and more realistic for a company, at least in terms of their web service that's been operating at a high level consistently, still trading at a multiple many, many, many times over earnings as their price-to-earnings ratio continues to float north of 300.
We switch gears to somewhat surprising news by the way of Bloomberg, who indicates that True Value may be exploring sale options. True Value, which we discussed here recently with their annual report, as having modest but impressive sales growth given their competition, is a hardware retailer that is privately owned in an independent cooperative framework. So it is interesting that they do give an annual report discussing the financials for the company for those stores that give their information. But in addition to hardware, they also have equipment rental supply stores, garden centers, and a large international footprint with a presence in 58 different countries. Again, this is through licensing deals and franchising deals. Over 4,400 different locations served within all of these different physical concepts. In total, their sales, or as they put it, gross billings in 2016 saw $2.07 billion in revenue. Comp store sales has seen three straight years of growth, most recently coming in at around 2.5% in 2016. That's a positive 2.5%. Only 1,700 locations actually report that data, though. Revenue coming into the co-op management via royalty with participating stores totaled $1.51 million. Revenue was up 1% year over year, or 1.1%. Moreover, this contributed to a net margin for the company, the very company that holds these royalty rights, around $23,689. This ends up being used as a patronage dividend. But this story may not be as much about True Value as those trying to take over the operation, as True Value looks to be up for sale, or it's at least reported that they're looking to auction themselves up for at least $800 million. So a lot of interesting news. And again, this is a fairly short story, but it's more interesting than anything given the current market and the growing home improvement sector in the United States.
Because True Value is an independently owned cooperative, a sale would mean certainly a disruption of their current business structure. And they would have to figure out, in terms of that sale price, what exactly is included. And given the fact that the royalties coming in total just $1.51 million, it seems very obvious that they're not just buying the name and the rights to the cooperative here. The rights would be much deeper than that if that sale price were to go for $800 million. Now, according to a report in the Chicago Tribune, Ace Hardware would be among the interested parties if such a sale were to take place. Ace Hardware, an interesting thing about them is they've actually managed to finish first in customer satisfaction ratings for home improvement stores now several years in a row, and they're actually headquartered near where True Value is in the Chicago metro area. Ace's model is similar to that of True Value. They're not publicly traded. Most locations are franchised, so it's not a situation like Home Depot or Lowe's where you have corporate ownership. Instead, you have franchised locations, but Ace doesn't make any money through royalties or fees outside of the initial application and startup fees. Where they make their money is through the product sourcing. So the private label brands that Ace is able to sell to their connected stores, that's where they make their money. And that's a selling point for them as they try to lure small independent stores into the Ace umbrella or banner, so that they don't take those royalty costs that True Value does. And this is very unique, whether we're talking about retail here or even food services, that Ace just makes money in terms of the sale of those private label goods. Ace Hardware is just as big nearly as True Value. They have 4,800 stores globally, just 400 more than True Value, so very similar size chains, but partially as a function of the way the business is structured, because they're not a co-op, because they have a franchise model. Ace's top line revenues were much higher than True Value's, around 2.5 times higher at $5.1 billion. You compare that to the $2.07 billion in revenue that True Value brought in last year. But I think perhaps the bigger note here for Ace is that they are increasing their top line revenues faster than True Value's. 1.6% annual sales increases at Ace versus 1.1% for True Value. Both of these chains have robust same-store sales and compared to the rest of the retail climate, maybe not compared to Home Depot's been throwing out video game numbers of late. Now, in terms of the implications, Leighton, very tough to tell. As we mentioned, they would have to disrupt the way their business runs if they were to be sold off. But there have been more than a few home improvement rumors that have been swirling. And I think, Leighton, unfortunately, at this time, if you're looking for mergers and acquisitions, if you're rooting for mergers and acquisitions, right now, because the home improvement sector is having so much success, it's going to be difficult for acquiring companies to drive those valuations down.
Yeah, and just to be frank, this is a very interesting story because Ace said that they've heard that they're going to be up for auction, or at least auctioning themselves in the near future, True Value is, but they haven't yet heard anything directly from the company. So this is all really just conjecture. And two, you see that a lot of home improvement rumors have been swirling around earlier this year, one being Lumber Liquidators being acquired by Home Depot. So there's a lot of talk in this space because the home improvement market is getting bigger. And according to an IHS study, they're seeing growth around 5 to 6% annually for home improvement products. So a lot of interesting things to look at. How exactly would Ace Hardware leverage some sort of buyout here? And this is something you and I were talking about before recording, and that there's not a lot of synergies. Yes, there's some overlap in their stores and in some of their markets throughout the Midwest, but overall, you're seeing two companies that are very similar in nature, both companies that have similar margins, and yes, both companies are profitable, but overall, you're not really seeing a growth proposition from Ace Hardware with this. It's going to have to be something bigger, and this is something that really wasn't mentioned by Ace Hardware executives. They weren't saying why they were so interested in this potential opportunity. Speaking of opportunity, the overall market opportunity for the home improvement sector is said to be around $25 billion. So from a growth perspective, that's something. And Ace Hardware does seem to have selling power and is doing a better job at selling through their individual locations than True Value. And like I said, they're both profitable, but margins could be contracting as Home Depot and Lowe's keep expanding their product assortment and their e-commerce presence. This is something we talk about every single quarter, as both Lowe's and Home Depot seem to beat on earnings either every quarter or every other quarter. And Ace, for their part, they do have a buy online, pick up in store program. So if you're talking about one synergy, one way that they can really improve the True Value business by acquisition, perhaps it could be something like this, an omni-channel setup, and then obviously lowering the cost of goods sold. And those are important keys if you're going to compete with those larger competitors in this space. Ace does have a better logistics program as well, and they could leverage that network for the benefit of both banners. They have 17 distribution centers throughout the United States versus True Value's 13. They're also having some state-of-the-art distribution centers as well. Some are actually larger than some of True Value's largest. Lastly, the Chicago Tribune noted that other competitors could be interested. So it's not just going to be Ace Hardware that could have a potential bid for the sale of True Value, but they had actually mentioned Amazon, as many point to the spontaneous home improvement items as being Amazon proof. A lot of people have been saying this over and over again. If you need something immediately for that home project, or if you're a contractor and you need X amount of items within a day or two, those larger facilities are going to be those areas that Amazon really can't compete too well against. And you see, this could be one way that Amazon does get a firm grip on the sector. The one point here is that they do have a larger footprint than Whole Foods, which of course Amazon, as we've talked about time and time again, who was just offered $13.4 billion. And if you compare the price tags, this is 16 times the rumored True Value price tag. So obviously, any larger company will have a little bit deeper pockets than an Ace Hardware. So a lot could play out here, and this is something we'll definitely keep our eye on as rumors become facts.
To the listeners of the Retail Focus podcast, you ever wonder why the coffee you make at home never quite tastes as good as the coffee you buy at a coffee shop at your local, I don't know, third wave coffee shop? Well, here's the secret. Coffee shops spend thousands of dollars to make the perfect water for making coffee. And now for as little as 10 cents per cup, you can duplicate that magic at home with Third Wave Water.
That's right, Trent, you sure can. And Third Wave Water does have a patent-pending formula of minerals that, when added to a gallon of distilled water, makes for what they call coffee brewing magic. Recently at the U.S. Brewers Cup Championship, both the first and second place finishers brewed their coffee with Third Wave Water.
Check out their website at thirdwavewater.com and use the promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order. That's promo code FOCUS for 10% off your first order at Third Wave Water and thirdwavewater.com. Well, it is July 14th, which is Bastille Day in France, actually. To that end, we're using our partnership with Racked and Racked.com to bring in Eliza Brooks. She's a senior reporter with Racked, and recently, in fact, last week, she put up an article, How to Sell a Billion-Dollar Myth Like a French Girl. It's an article she's been working on for a long period of time. It's had some great response, and we figured we would bring her on to the Retail Focus podcast to talk a little bit about the French style and the French girl, either myth or trope, in
U.S. retail. And so, Eliza, thank you very much for joining us on the Retail Focus podcast.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so some of our listeners might be thinking, like, what is this French girl thing? If they're not familiar maybe with fashion or beauty retail, they may not be familiar with this. So what is the French girl? What defines a French girl? Kind of where did that image come from in the U.S.?
Absolutely. Who is she and does she even exist? So the French girl, we'll back up a little bit. So France, I think there's kind of this understanding in the U.S. that they do a lot of stuff better than we do. Food, wine, kind of all these aesthetic lifestyle components. So the French girl has kind of become this media trope perpetuated by women's lifestyle publications, which publish a lot of articles like how to do your hair like a French girl, how to do date night style like a French girl, how to do Valentine's Day like a French girl, kind of using the French girl as this lightning rod for everything that women want to be, which is effortless, chic, stylish, you know, and very and understated too. And she kind of represents this better version of ourselves and this better life that everybody's chasing after. Is it real? That's questionable. There are so many French women who do not bicycle along the Seine with a baguette tucked under their arms. But there is some truth to this myth.
That would be perhaps a funnier mental image of France if you just pictured, you know, 100 French women bicycling along the
all
Seine
of them.
In that way.
It's like the Tour de France every day, but it's, you know, they're in mini skirts and blowing kisses at the passersby.
So I'll ask, how did you arrive at this subject? I know you've been working on this article for a long time prior to when it was posted last week. What drew your interest to this subject?
Totally. I mean, I think it's really that media thing. And this is because I'm a reporter, so I'm kind of in this mix every day. But it is hard to go a day and impossible to go a week without seeing a new article about this French girl. And so it really came out of this kind of frustration with something that was like, just has become a complete joke. I mean, it's just a way to get clicks because people are really, really interested in it. So, you know, it started as that, but then I started wondering, okay, well, there is a business here. I mean, it's a business for media companies because obviously we need traffic to survive. And there are also self-help books like French Women Don't Get Fat, How to Be Parisian Wherever You Are. There are a number of others. And then it also clearly extends to fashion. I mean, like Chanel as a brand is, you know, represents a lot of things, but it also represents kind of this French luxury business that's really aspirational for a lot of people. So I started just thinking about how far this economy goes, and that's how it really became a business story.
So you mentioned Chanel. There are a number of other specific companies that you mentioned in the article, some of them based out of France. Some of them are based in the U.S. that play on France that don't actually have ties to France. And I think this is perhaps what I found almost the most interesting thing out of the article. What do some of these U.S.-based brands and what are they doing to appear authentic as French brands and appeal to the U.S. consumer that might be obsessed with this idea of the French stereotype?
It's interesting. There's kind of this line between authenticity and then there's also just this kind of like slap the phrase French girl on it or the word France on it, add like an Eiffel Tower and like maybe paint things in red, white, and blue, a color blocked, not stars and stripes. And then you've got a French product. So it's true. There are a number of brands that are based in the U.S. that do kind of capitalize on this. One that I spoke to the founder of is French Girl Organics, which obviously has the phrase French Girl in the name. And it's quite a lovely skincare brand that's carried at Anthropologie. So it has reached mass distribution, but it was founded by a woman who lives in Seattle. And she is an organic farmer and started making her own skincare products and started selling them on Etsy and has scaled up her business from there. You know, it's interesting. Her packaging is inspired by a number of things, Scandinavian design, Japanese design. It's quite minimal, but it's also inspired by Chanel. And the products are described in both English and France on the jars. And so it does, you know, by virtue of the language, by virtue of the aesthetics of it, and just having it in the name, it creates this image of, oh, well, maybe this will help me become a French girl too.
As you were researching this story and as you were kind of looking at some of the U.S. retailers that include a number of French or French-themed products in their stores, you mentioned Anthropologie, of course, is one. Mm-hmm. What were some of the trends that you were noticing in terms of how retailers stock these products or how retailers market these products to the consumer above and beyond just the brand name?
Totally. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes it's just a matter of having them in the store. I mean, I spoke to the fashion director of Bloomingdale's, and, you know, one of the things that she mentioned was, it was around 5 to 7 years ago, Bloomingdale's started carrying Sandro, Maje, and the Couples, and I believe Zadig and Voltaire, which are all French contemporary brands. And at the time, she felt, you know, other U.S. department stores weren't carrying them. And for Bloomingdale's at the time, it was really a good way to differentiate their product assortment. And I can't say for sure, I'm not sure how they marketed it at the time, but these are kind of known French brands. So I think purely just having them in the store offers something enticing to consumers who can kind of fill in that aspirational blank for themselves there. And then, of course, you know, there's also more overt advertising. You know, I see this quite a lot as a reporter, but I get a lot of press releases for, you know, products that will make you look like a French girl. So it may not always be apparent to consumers. I certainly see it, but it's there.
You mentioned in the article, and you kind of describe the typical way a French girl or the stereotypical French girl would wear makeup and different makeup trends. Regarding this French girl stereotype, what are some ways in which some of the beauty retailers that we've seen explosive growth from in this country, but some of these beauty retailers, how has it changed the way in which they market some of their makeup, or has it changed?
That's a good question. And I think it's a really important one too, because as you know, beauty is showing such growth right now, apparel, not so much. And beauty is a really core part of this. In terms of what the kind of French girl beauty look is, you know, it's kind of presented in the literature quite uniformly as, you know, kind of messy hair. It's kind of bedhead, very disheveled, but, you know, that's quite sexy. And, you know, bare skin, generally speaking, not much foundation and, you know, maybe a red lip. So it's quite natural. And, you know, trying to create this look of it being very effortless, like you just did it and ran out the door. It's quite undone, which I think is very appealing. It's also interestingly so different from the kind of Kylie Jenner lip kit look that we've seen so much in the U.S. right now. You know, quite heavy foundation, very matte lipsticks that are in very unnatural colors. So it kind of runs counter to some trends that we're seeing in the beauty space generally. But as far as how U.S. retailers have capitalized on this, I mean, one thing that we've seen is a slow but significant invasion of French pharmacy brands into U.S. drugstores. So Duane Reade in New York, Rite Aid, CVS, Walgreens, you know, are starting to carry some French pharmacy brands, which are kind of recognized. Beauty editors see them as kind of the cream of the crop as far as like inexpensive cult products go. And we've also seen retailers, or brands rather, like Simple, the skincare brand, and Garnier's skincare line, replicating popular French products like micellar water, which is kind of a no-wash face cleanser.
So you talk about some of the French brands that are being installed increasingly in U.S. retailers. Are there French retailers that are also kind of making inroads into the United States? Where do you see growth in terms of entire retail stores setting up shop here?
Oh, that's a good question. You know, I haven't really. I feel like that's something that we haven't seen a ton of. It's more kind of on a brand basis. Yeah.
Eliza Brooke, a senior reporter with Racked and Racked.com, joining us on the Retail Focus podcast, talking about her article that debuted last week on Racked.com, How to Sell a $1 Billion Myth Like a French Girl. So we've talked a little bit about brands. We've talked a little bit about brick and mortar retailers. And coming up next month, we've got a lot regarding e-commerce and kind of the lead up to shop.org in Los Angeles that the NRF has in September. As you were looking through all of the vast amounts of information out there for this article, what are some of the up-and-coming brands that you saw that might impact the industry in a meaningful way, or might even impact the e-commerce industry in a meaningful way?
I think with this story, one, this is not an up-and-coming brand, but Amazon has been pretty important, I would say, in distributing French beauty products to the U.S. You know, it wasn't very long ago that it was pretty hard to find them here. I mean, it was kind of models and makeup artists who would go to Paris for Fashion Week and they would stock up on all the good stuff there and bring it back. Or someone you know is studying abroad and they would bring stuff back for you. Amazon really increased the distribution there. So while it does have a brick and mortar presence, that's been huge for getting it over here. This is kind of less specific to the whole French girl thing, but I think Anthropology also on the beauty front has been doing really great work on picking up small brands like French Girl Organics. So that's kind of them tapping into this trend. But they have a really good program in working on developing products with young beauty brands who, you know, maybe don't have a ton of distribution yet and exposing them to a broader shopper base.
So on the e-commerce note, one of the things I really liked about the article was you provided a lot of historical perspective on kind of how the French girl developed or how the French girl image developed in the United States. Do you feel like with obviously the internet dissemination of information goes a lot more quickly? There are things such as clickbait articles, for example, now where there weren't 50 years ago. Do you think the French girl has evolved due to things like e-commerce, things like news websites and that type of thing?
Oh, 100%. I mean, she's a meme is the thing. You know, she's always been around, but it's with particularly digital media. Everybody's kind of zeroed in on it in a very intense way. It's really taken on a very, very specific meaning thanks to digital media, particularly, and also sites like Pinterest. I mean, you see it a lot there too. Instagram probably less, but yeah, no, I'll go back to that. Like, she's become a meme.
And a little bit later on in the article, you mentioned some brands that are maybe taking advantage of some of this fatigue regarding this French girl trope. What are some examples of what other brands are doing that are kind of taking advantage of the backlash, if you will, against the French girl idea?
Absolutely. I mean, this is one of my favorite parts of the narrative is that it's become this thing that we're all so exhausted with, but we keep clicking on it. I mean, I do this, right? I should know better than to click on that article, but like I still do because it's still appealing. And there has been quite a lot of backlash. New York Magazine published a very funny article titled 97 Things You Can Do Like a French Girl, which just was a roundup of every single internet article about this. And then you have brands doing it too. So there's one that's based out of London. It was founded by two Australians. It's called Etre Cecile. It has this very cheeky approach to manipulating the French girl trope. They'll put French phrases on t-shirts, but misspell them a little bit. The girl who they design for is this French girl, but they'll go and put her in Los Angeles and kind of think about like, what would she look like if she were there for, you know, a summer in the 1970s? So they have a lot of fun with it. They did a collaboration with Man Repeller, which is a wonderful fashion website. And they created t-shirts that said, am I French yet? So they get it. Like they're playing into it and they're playing into the fact that everybody knows this is, you know, a ruse, but we're going to go along with it because it's fun and because it still is aspirational. One other place that we see this is the how-to literature. I mean, a big, very obvious part of this economy is the publishing industry. I mean, there are a lot of self-help books, essentially, that get published about how to become more French. And one that I really love is called How to Be Parisian Wherever You Are. It was published in 2014 by four women who are French, are Parisian. And the whole thing is kind of, it's an exercise in contradictions, and it's an exercise in kind of pointing out the flaws in this mythology, the fact that she doesn't really exist, the fact that she's not effortless. She does put in a lot of effort to look so cool and nonchalant. But at the end of the day, the idea of being French, it's still alluring. It's presented in such a way that you're like, well, yeah, I want in on it.
There may not be an answer to this question, or at least an obvious one right now, but what, in your opinion, might the next French girl be? Is there a different culture, a different trope that might rise up here in the next 10 years?
That's a great question. You know, the Fashionista, which is a fashion website that I used to work for, after I left, started running this series called How to Be a Blank Girl, I think. I'm butchering this title of the series, but basically they were trying to offer up, hey, women from other cultures are really cool too and have great things to offer and things that we could learn from. I don't know, frankly. I think after Master of None season 2 came out, I think there was a lot of talk about Italian girls. So that, you know, is something that we could get behind. But I don't know. We'll have to see.
Couple more questions here as we wrap up the interview. Again, touching on the fact that you did quite a bit of research for this article. Your article touches heavily on the fashion and beauty industries. We've talked in the past on the show about how Yoplait, for example, the yogurt brand owned by General Mills, is rolling out a new French-style yogurt this summer. Are there other industries besides beauty and fashion that are seeing kind of some spillover from this French girl effect?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's harder to trace for sure, but I would say there's a reason rosé has become so popular, and I'm forgetting who had this figure, but growth in rosé is outpacing the rest of the wine industry currently, and it's so popular in the US right now. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that it's incredibly Instagrammable. It's pink, millennial pink has become like a very popular color among young women, particularly. So I think it has a lot of other stuff going for it, but it's also, it's French. I mean, it's a French word. It has that beautiful accent on it. And I think it fits very beautiful into this whole kind of fantasy world. So I would say that that's one for sure. But yeah, I think it's, you know, across the board, French products get a certain lift from this luxurious aura surrounding them.
What's the article response been since the article went up last week?
Oh, it's been huge. Honestly, even within the first 24 hours, I had so many responses to it on Twitter and Facebook and people emailing me directly. It's very gratifying because I think it really just indicates that, like, this is a thing that people are paying attention to and that they've noticed also. I'm certainly not the only one. I think it's also just, it indicates something that I believe to be very true, which is that consumers are really smart. They know what you're doing, and they see that all these websites are publishing story after story about how to be a French girl, and they see that brands are capitalizing on it, and they may still click on it because it, as I said, still holds an appeal, but they see it. For that reason, I would just advise any brands that are kind of looking to capitalize on this to be very careful about how authentic it is and how merited French girl branding is in that situation.
Finally, and this is a little bit more on the personal side, what articles do you have in the pipeline for RACT? What's kind of the next story that you're looking at covering?
Definitely. Currently working on one that I'm realizing is much deeper than I thought it was, about the branding look that's kind of emerged as the look of 2010s lifestyle startups, that minimal sans serif, primary color heavy look that, you know, Outdoor Voices, Warby Parker, Casper, a whole number of brands adhere to. I'm kind of trying to trace like where this came from, talk to the art directors who created it, and figure out where it's going. Because that's always the question, right? It's exactly what you were asking. And who's the next girl after the French girl? I really want to know where this style of branding is going, because it's so ubiquitous right now.
All right, that sounds absolutely fantastic. We can
come back and talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. That would be great, because design is something that we take great interest in here on the podcast. So we'll be looking forward to that article. Eliza Brooks, senior reporter with RACT and RACT.com, about our article, How to Sell a $1 Billion Myth Like a French Girl. Bloomberg broke the true value story. They break another important retail news facet this week as Albertsons and their private equity firm postpone a potential IPO that they've been kicking around now for the last couple of years. And this ties right into Amazon and Whole Foods, what we ended the prior news segment discussing. That deal has been pointed to as having hurt grocery retail valuations in the U.S. We saw Kroger within the span of 2 days lose about a third of their market cap. We see supermarkets throughout the country, including Ingles Markets, also losing massive amounts off their market cap. And of course, Blue Apron's IPO was hurt severely by this deal. Now, the grocery market in the U.S. is a near $1 trillion market, and nearly all publicly traded companies in this $1 trillion market that have a hand in that grocery market were harmed in terms of shareholder pessimism after the deal was announced. We've mentioned, of course, Kroger, but also Sprouts, and even Target was harmed. And now it looks like Albertsons, who is technically the number three grocer in the United States, may put off their IPO for just a little bit longer until some of this pessimism passes on.
They have been growing through acquisition over the past few years, Albertsons has, and most recently were rumored to be eyeing the aforementioned Sprouts, which is a publicly traded company known for having a wide variety and assortment of organics, all natural items, and constant promotion. So a lot of new vantage points that they are offering the grocery industry. But most notably, Albertsons grew through a buyout of Safeway stores in January of 2015. They bought those stores for around $9 billion, and now the chain has around 2,300 locations in total in 34 states with a total of 18 banners with Safeway included. Over 250,000 employees are employed inside the United States. So a massive, massive grocery business here. Bloomberg reported that this Tuesday that the IPO has been delayed. So despite the breadth that they bring to the table, despite the overall market size and the impacts they can make on the industry, management has decided, or at least upper management ranks have decided, to put off again an IPO offering. And you're seeing that there's going to be around 2 years in total now that management has been waiting on the sidelines to issue an IPO. According to Bloomberg sources, the company had been wanting to get a $12.4 billion valuation. The Whole Foods deal is worth about $13.4 billion, as I had noted earlier, to put it in perspective. Kroger's stock is down significantly for the year. They still have a $20.7 billion market cap. And I list these numbers to put it in perspective, because here we're talking about the number three grocer inside the United States. And Albertsons Safeway has over 2,300 stores, whereas Kroger has nearly 2,800 stores. So this would suggest a valuation north of Whole Foods for sure, at one maybe slightly less than Kroger right now. So overall, you can see that the market isn't particularly happy with the grocery retail sector, and a large part has to do with that Amazon Whole Foods deal, and to see where that really goes, if that deal closes, when that deal closes, and the implications from that deal. But right now, it really seems to be undervaluing grocers right now, or at least the market is undervaluing. And you see, even with Kroger right now at a $22, $23 price point, their market cap is significantly down from what it was just a month ago. So you're seeing that not only that is going to be an indicator here for how long they're going to be waiting for this IPO, but Albertsons is also looking at, as you mentioned, Trent, a sluggish IPO market. One notable IPO here recently was Blue Apron, which we had actually covered on the Food Focus podcast. They had failed to really outperform their expectations on the week of their IPO, Trent. And this is really a leading indicator right now, even though there aren't a lot of hot IPOs hitting a market, not a lot of what they call unicorns hitting the market. But this is very interesting in that this is a mature business. So it's not necessarily a fresh startup that has a lot of excitement around it. But Blue Apron really does tie into the grocery market share.
It does, and I think that was one of the reasons why Albertsons was a little spooked. You talk about unicorns. Albertsons would really be a unicorn times 12 or 13, and they're this massive privately held company. They're already relatively mature as a company, and so the IPO is just a way for that private equity firm to kind of cash in on their investments as they've been able to grow Albertsons through acquisition over the last 5 to 10 years. And when we look overall at the IPO market, Leighton mentioned how Blue Apron isn't necessarily in the same market segment. However, meal kits were said to have a large market opportunity, one that might steal market share away from brick and mortar retailers in terms of grocery sales. But as of Tuesday of this week, Blue Apron was trading at around 24% below their IPO price tag, which, as we reported on our sister podcast, The Food Focus, they'd been looking for around a price of $15 to $17 per share. They ended up just getting $10 per share, and given the fact that they were only releasing about a third of the shares in the IPO, their initial valuation still sits north of $1 million. Now the company's shares are around $7.40. What we see in aggregate is that while stocks are trading at fairly high multiples, and when we talk about multiples, we're talking about that price to earnings ratio overall, stocks related to the grocery industry seem to be one of the few soft spots. It is not uncommon for us to see price to earnings ratios south of 15, even for companies that are growing at a hasty rate, like Kroger, for example, growing both through internal sources and external acquisition. So no reason for Albertsons not to just kick the can on the IPO down the road. No reason to rush into an IPO and then get shortchanged by several billion dollars simply because of bad timing and because of market worries regarding Amazon.
We close our news segment with Deloitte's annual back-to-school survey for retailers, which shows increasing trends towards early shopping, or at least people that shop earlier spending more money. According to the survey, parents will spend a whopping $501 per student on school items in the lead up to the 2017-2018 school year. Extrapolate that, and one can easily figure a multi-billion dollar market proposition in the United States. One quick note, clothing is, of course, included in this. So you've got things like clothing, backpacks, and your typical school supplies all glommed together in this group. 55% of the money here will be going towards apparel. So clothing, fashion does make up over $250 per this 501 per students. This reflects a growth rate of 10% year over year for apparel. School supplies coming in at around 20% of this 501 mark, and 14% towards computers and other electronics. We thought this might be higher, but some of this might be lumped in with the 9% that are going to tech items that could include tablets for students. Bottom line, and basically the main point of the study and what we're going to talk about here on the podcast, is that this study found that parents that start early, before August, which is when most schools get back in session, not all the way throughout the country, but most of them, spend more than those who shop later. So if you shop prior to August 1st, you're going to spend more on a per student basis. 60% of early shoppers spend $31 per student more overall. So they're well above the mean in terms of their average expenditures. Those who spend after August 1st see an average of just $458 leave their pocketbooks for each student, so a significant margin below. Now, this is all interesting, and Leighton, there were a lot of headlines extolling the fact that retailers needed to get people into the stores sooner because that would then drive back-to-school expenditures up, but we see some problems with the data in terms of that suggestion.
Yeah, and that was one of the main things that media outlets were covering from this study. And while the study and the data all seem to be very nicely put together, you wonder if this was, in fact, the right thing to be drawing from this survey. The fact that maybe retailers should be opening up back-to-school sales a little bit earlier. But the idea here is that if all retailers were to have earlier sales, the higher per student average would eventually come down, meaning that if everybody shopped earlier, obviously everything is going to be equal long term from the economic standpoint. And this is not to say that more sales would take place overall anyway. Some may have budgets that will always be capping the total amount spent for back to school items. And the second problem that you and I had with this was, maybe more importantly, there are those families that will wait for school supply clearance sales, which is what our parents actually did because they were very cheap. But this will inevitably happen as large features in stores like Target are broken down and downsized in order to fit in seasonal offerings with the Halloween market and other incoming seasonal merchandise in the holiday seasons towards the end of the year. And I'd actually worked for a couple retailers that would try to rush out back to school merchandise literally right at the end of August. So kids are just now in school. They've been in school for about 2 weeks. And even though there was a ton of inventory left, they would have some steep markdowns and people would just come in and take advantage of those items in hopes to use them next year. And so I think that's what a lot of people are doing. So this study really does fail to acknowledge some simple supply and demand economics here with the back-to-school seasonality. But it is not as if 100% of back-to-school shoppers are buying the bulk of their products in the latter half of the season or completely unaware that retailers have actually started off early either. So some of those people are trying to take advantage of clearance sales. Some are just procrastinating. So it's not as though they're not seeing that newspaper ads, the television ads, from all the major retailers spending millions of dollars on promotion. It's not as though they're not seeing those and going into those stores earlier or aware that they can at least attempt to go in and buy those school supplies a little earlier. So I think now the market is extremely mature. So this study kind of leaves off some of these ideas about social economics, and basically correlation doesn't equal causation here. The study doesn't indicate that parents who shop early spend more because they shop earlier. It could be that these parents will spend X amount regardless of the products that hit the stores. In the end, beyond clothing, at least, sales are drifting online. And this is something we had discussed with Staples here recently as they are looking to be taken private. They've aggressively looked to reinvest outside of brick and mortar stores as they look to be more in the online and e-commerce space. And this is something we've talked about with Amazon time and time again. Yes, there are some things that are Amazon proof, but I'll tell you what, Trent, school supplies are not one of them.
That is certainly the case. And I wanted to kind of convey to our listeners a few long-term trends that we're at least keeping our eye on above and beyond this study. So we're taking this study, we've commented on the study, and now we kind of want to add a few additional things to the study. Now, it goes without saying that back-to-school timing varies in different areas throughout the country, with some schools getting out in early May, some as late June. And I think this is important, at least as far as retailers are concerned, as this study suggests that perhaps retailers should move their sales to an earlier date. However, if your market gets out of school late, it can be difficult to balance those seasonal shelves in a store. In order to run those early back-to-school displays in those markets, they've got to sacrifice the typical summer displays because you usually have a seasonal section of a retail store. If you think about your traditional general merchandise retailers, your Targets, your Walmarts, you've got that seasonal section towards the front of the store. They'd have to sacrifice the typical summer displays, those beach towels, picnic materials, outdoor decor, sunscreen, and so forth, in exchange for some of those back-to-school items. Do the same thing in the fashion segments of the store as well. And Layton was just talking about how a lot of retailers will rush to get back-to-school stuff off the shelves by September 1st so they can start stocking with Halloween and other seasonal merchandise. But this would be the same thing if they started carrying these back-to-school items earlier. That means you've got to break down all the summer stuff earlier because there's only so much shelf space in a store. So there's ultimately a cap on running back-to-school seasonal pushes early, and I think we've kind of reached that plateau at this point because you can't run it before school gets out in certain markets because that takes away from your early summer seasonality, and consumers aren't in the mentality of yet stocking up for the next school year. So as attractive as it might be to attempt to entice parents to do early shopping because those particular parents do spend more, they might do so while sacrificing other segments, and segments that honestly may be more profitable than that 19-cent notebook or that 29-cent box of crayons. As we mentioned earlier, correlation doesn't equal causation, so you might end up with this merchandising chasm between the early birds who shop right when you throw out all that back-to-school merchandise and everyone else who either shops at the last minute or waits on the clearance sales, meaning that that merchandise is sitting on shelves with very little turnover for a few weeks when you could be using that space for something else that's a little bit more seasonal. And again, that's the most valued space, or one of the most valued spaces, in your general merchandise retailers. Another large trend to watch is the increasing digitalization of schools, and this is something not even Amazon has an answer for. Schools of all types, even elementary schools, are engaging increasingly in one-for-one initiatives where students have school-assigned Chromebooks or other devices, laptops, tablets. Additionally, schools are almost entirely transitioning to learning management systems, so online cloud-driven systems such as PowerSchool that were once reserved only for university students. These systems dictate how students turn in homework and even in some cases how they work on math problems. They're no longer using a lot of paper, so by increasingly moving towards tech, they're reducing the need for students to have massive packs of crayons, a lot of notebook paper, pens, pencils, and so forth. And in fact, where I'm located, the school essential list for middle school is dwindled down to just a few things. You're looking from where it was 5 years ago, 15 to 20 items for a middle schooler. Now it's around 5, and most of those are technologically based. So if we begin to see decreased back-to-school sales, know that it's not all Amazon's fault in this circumstance. We'll likely see bumps in fashion continually, as we noted with fashion increasing year over year. Items like jump drives, computers, backpacks, those will see bumps, but we see traditional school supplies and the market for those probably declining over the next 5 to 10 years, which is fine because a lot of those smaller items were loss leaders for stores.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
now time for our Looking Ahead segment, where each Leighton and I discuss a story that we're looking ahead to over the next week or the next month. And Leighton, we begin with you as you're looking towards the toy segment.
Yeah, I am. And more importantly, JCPenney Company, which is looking to take part in that toy segment, which is reported to be a $20 to $25 billion industry in the United States. And here recently, we've talked about Toys R Us and their declining sales. However, you see a lot of other retailers trying to take advantage of this still growing area in the marketplace. You see the toy industry is actually growing year over year. Well, the news came out here this week that the Plano-based retailer is going to have roughly a 500 square foot piece of the pie dedicated to toys. So they're going to introduce some toy aisles, sort of a store within a store concept. And if you think back to what JCPenney has done in the recent past with Nike and Sephora store within a store concepts, this is right down the alley of a very good, very interesting and smart way of trying to utilize their square footage, their very large square footage in some of these mall locations that they have. And you see that a large part of their sales is still made up from those apparel and fashion items, about 55 to 65%, depending on the particular market, the particular locations you're talking about, is made up of those apparel sales. But you see that that's actually declining year over year. And this is one of the reasons why you see a lot of pessimism around retailers like JCPenney and Macy's and things like that. But JCPenney is not resting on its laurels here. They're really trying to take advantage of areas that are seeing growth. And you're seeing toy sales as an industry in the United States is growing 5% year over year. So I really love this concept, and I'm curious to see how this plays out for JCPenney. Definitely something I am looking forward to when reading the earnings call transcript in the next couple of quarters as this begins to roll out not only on brick and mortar, but also on their e-commerce site as well.
Well, Layton's looking at a company that's very much looking to expand into different areas. I'm looking at a company that's already basically declined and gone through bankruptcy in H.H. Gregg. Their intellectual property rights and their name sold at court this last week for $400,000 to Valor LLC. They actually outbid, get this, Sears Holdings Corporation, which I have no idea why Sears Holdings was attempting to bid on H.H. Gregg. Maybe they're trying to collect a cadre of names of famous or once famous retailers that have declined since then. But Valor won the intellectual property rights for about $400,000. The Indianapolis Business Journal tried to draw a possible link between the company principal, Michael Eisner, that is Valor's company principal, to maybe what they could be using the name for. Eisner is tied into Brooklyn's Circuit Street LLC, which is a separate business which offers technology and drones and digital cameras. Potentially, they're looking to use the names, or potentially they're looking to use customer lists. And oftentimes, these bankruptcy auctions take place and the name gets auctioned off and we never hear from it again. That was the case when Children's Palace and Child World, longtime listeners of the podcast will remember, when we did kind of a retrospective on them and their bankruptcy in the early 90s, nothing ever came of that name being purchased at auction. And that's the case more often than not. But just in case, I'll be keeping a side eye on H.H. Gregg and seeing if that brand pops up again, just like Service Merchandise and some other fairly popular brands have in the past. That'll do it for us here on the Retail Focus Podcast. For Leighton, I'm Trent. Check us out on Twitter at Retail Podcast. Also, shoot us an email, retailpodcast@gmail.com. If you've got an idea for a story, or maybe if there's something that we've missed on a previous podcast, our ears are always open. We'll also be at shop.org in late September in Los Angeles. Check that out at shop.org. Use the promo code FOCUS10 for 10% off your registration. Again, we'll be back 1 week from now with more retail news.
Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.